On this week's 51%, a sports psychologist talks about female athletes.
One of the things that is often important in girls' team sports is that the girls like each other enough that they can play together well enough.
A star basketball player gets to have a baby and her game, plus a writer returns to her roots. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on, go play. Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on, get paid. All that glitters is gold. Only shooting stars break the mold.
Sisterhood in Sports, How Female Athletes Collaborate and Compete, is a book by clinical and sports psychologist Dr. Joan Steidinger, herself a highly accomplished athlete. It illuminates how the female brain works differently from that of men, how women achieve at the same high level as men but relate to others within their sport in their own way. Her book covers a gamut of sports with various athletes, including former Olympians, professional athletes, and school athletes. Dr. Steidinger, who resides in California, is a certified consultant through the Association of Applied Sports Psychology and is on the United States Olympic Committee's Sports Psychology Registry. In the 1990s, she was a competitive ultra runner.
You know, the thing about my book is it came from really my personal and clinical experience. And it started with the Women Who Love Too Much book, where it made women all pathological for focusing on relationships from an emotional perspective. And I just wanted to point out that we're different. And we need to acknowledge those differences, and we're going to enjoy and play a lot better and succeed. But the problem is, in the world at large, in the working world, it's still a male framework.
Women are not small men. And how does that sentence pertain to sports?
Well, it's funny. It's a quote actually on my back of my book from Allison Dunlap, who's a world champion cross-country mountain biker and two-time Olympian. And one of the things that has concerned me forever, and one of the reasons I wrote the book, is because women are constantly told to be more like men, and we're not. We have a different style and a different approach due to both our psychological and our neuropsychological makeup. Lots of research has been done in the last 10-plus years showing that our brain's strengths function in different ways than men's. And this has not been accounted for in terms of dealing with female athletes. And so the whole point of my book was to talk about that and the fact that we approach relationships from a more emotional and intimate standpoint, whereas men are, you know, from a more activity, thinking-based type of relationship. And so I wanted to really highlight the differences, so to allow men and women to be themselves.
Let's maybe write a team sport. And how would that play out, excuse the pun, differently from a team of women versus a team of men? How would an approach, pick any sport you want, and perhaps give an example of what would be different?
Well, I actually work with San Francisco State softball team. And one of the things that is often important in girls' team sports is that the girls like each other enough that they can play together well enough. And if you get a girl on a team sport who's a great player but not a very nice person, and it's pretty evident, you will have more disruption, whereas with a male team, you'll have the guys will go, okay, he's a great player. He's kind of a jerk, but he's a really great player, so we don't care. So women tend to operate more in a circular way. It's hierarchical, but it's also kind of peer-based because they want to bond together more on a more personal level, where men, the personal level isn't really in there near as much. And the emotion that they express is not the deep emotion that you get from women.
And you talk about the importance of mental strategy. What is that?
Say you're going into a run and your mind starts telling you things that are negative. you haven't trained enough, you know, you didn't eat right last night, you know, this other person is better than you. So the mind is starting going negative. And the other person's mind is like, okay, you trained well, you're fully fit, you know, you're going to go for it today. And they've got this positive mindset. Who do you think is going to win the race?
Let me guess, the positive mindset.
The person with the positive mindset. And what we don't do, I think, in sports still, is we don't prepare the athletes enough with their minds and working with them in a more positive way, which is really important for females. Not that we certainly all need feedback and critique and mild criticism about how to improve. But what we don't need is a lot of negative stuff in our head.
Are there still predominantly male coaches for women's teams?
Well, yeah, there's still, you know, the coaching thing is that a lot of coaches don't take time to sit back and understand women. I live in a small community, and I was at a Memorial Day parade talking to a woman who is an eight, competes in rowing in an eight boat. I was just talking about the previous week when all the women on the boat had some kind of emotional response to something, and he yelled at them that they should be more like men. And I told her that you should tell him that he needs to take the time to understand women. And I think male coaches haven't, and I think female coaches too. I mean, it's not limited to male coaches, because there's some really great male coaches that actually are in my book. So I think it's just informing coaches and their willingness to accept it.
You know, I wanted to ask you, and you talk about this a lot in your book, about what drives a female athlete and how is that drive different? And I know you spoke to this a little bit at the beginning. Is it winning? Is it doing the best? Is it what is it?
No, I think with women, it can be winning. But if they're not having a good time, you know, if they're not executing their skills really well and having some fun, winning doesn't mean as much because they want to embrace, you know, one of the things I suggest in the book too is to embrace competition as opposed to have to focus on the other team or other person that you're competing against. You know, compete against yourself and keep striving and working to do personal best. And I think winning does drive some women more than others. But I also think there's a lot of other qualities that have to be present to make women enjoy the experience and stay with a sport.
Like what you mentioned at the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the bonding and the collaboration and the, talking to each other. You'll get some pro athletes. Like I interviewed an individual sport, Xterra off-road triathlete, who's also a PhD in performance psychology named Danelle Kabush, and she talks about being, and she was an excellent athlete forever, and she talks about being in high school and being way more interested in the social aspect of things than actually competing, even though she was doing well and winning. The social was really equally important for her.
Do any sports stand out as being contrary to what you're saying drives women and is part of the sisterhood of sports? Are there any sports that stand out as a bit different or out of the norm?
Well, no. You know, it's a really interesting question you ask, because when I was doing an event at Athleta over in Sacramento, this group of women who are in a football league, a semi-pro football league, came in. And you could see that they were like all best friends and that, you know, they really cared about each other and wanted people to join their team that had that same kind of connective ability. And so I don't know if I would say any sports. I would say there's situations. I would say there's teams. I was speaking to a university audience a few weeks ago, and it caught me totally unawares, but a coach says, oh, I just try to stir up conflict, you know, with the girls to help motivate them. And it's like, one of the things that women don't like is to get in a lot of conflict. And I thought, I was just kind of astounded because I've never heard a coach say that they purposely tried to, of females, they purposely tried to promote conflict.
Yeah, that's kind of odd. If you know anything about what you're talking about.
Yes, yes. And I said, well, I just said to her, well, that's unusual. I haven't really heard of that occurring before. But apparently it was vying for positions and that sort of thing. And recently I worked with volleyball players from a team, three different ones. Their coach had done that approach of, instead of being honest about bringing a new girl in, she brought a new girl in to play a position called the libero, which is a pretty critical position in on the team. And instead of even telling my client that she was doing this, she just brought her in, and all of a sudden it was like this really uncomfortable situation. And my client was like kind of giving up, you know, and not you know, fighting for her position. And I said, you know, you got to stand up and let's see how you can help you do your best, because, you know, if you do your best, you're going to hold on to your position. And so that's what we did. And, you know, she got the position back, but it was pretty uncomfortable. And people don't like her. They don't like the female coach at all, the girls on that team. So unfortunately, you know, when you see coaches like that, you certainly would wish you could unsee them. But a lot of times you can't. You have to kind of work around them. And both the girls that came in, I taught them not to focus all their energy on the coach, but to focus more on the team and themselves, so that they're playing for each other, because they were a pretty tight-knit team in terms of, like, you know, being friends and the such. You know, one of the things that's really important is that we need to be cared about. And so I think we're more sensitive to, like, a coach or even a father yelling at us in the field. I had a young woman and her father come in, and, you know, he would yell at her. She was a pitcher when she was pitching, and it wouldn't help her. It'd do the opposite effect. And as soon as he realized that the yelling was hurting her game, he stopped doing it. And consequently, their relationship got better and her game got better. And it was just a simple little intervention like that. Because other than that, she could be really positive about what she was doing and how she was playing.
Do you have a favorite female athlete or team?
Oh, boy. That's a big. Actually, you know, someone I really admire that's in my book, that I've met and heard in a keynote at a major convention last year, was Cheryl Swoops. She was the first basketball player recruited by the WNBA in the 90s. I thought it was very admirable that, first of all, they hung on to her when she was pregnant, and that she came back quickly after pregnancy to play. And it just showed, I think it demonstrated to us, that all this fragility that's been projected onto women is really not there to the degree that they like to think it is. I think the fact that women go through childbirth and struggle with that kind of pain and get through it is more than a lot of men understand. And just like they can come back and be incredible athletes after having children. And there's more and more young women who are competitive athletes having children and still continuing to be pros.
You know, she needs to get to Congress and help them pass some laws, because, you know, when we that's a whole other conversation, right? The wage gap, where is it in sports? I'm sure, you know, female athletes are earning a lot. The professional athletes, obviously, are earning a lot less than men, on comparable teams. And I imagine it's no different in the athletic world than it is in the corporate world, I imagine, when it comes to pay, right?
No, the divergence in pay is terrible all across the board.
You know, and that's psychological, too, when you think you're, you know, am I worth less?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Well, you know, there's a soccer player, Megan Rapinoe, who's been on the national team, and she left the States and went to France, where they recruited her for their women's soccer team, and she went from earning like, I don't know, $70,000 I think a year or something to earning $150,000. And there was all this big hullabaloo. Well, what man wouldn't do that? You know, they're going to double their salary. They're going to play somewhere else. Of course they'd do it. Nobody would make an issue of it.
That last sentence was key. No one would make an issue of it.
Right.
That was sports psychologist Dr. Joan Steidinger talking about her book, Sisterhood in Sports, How Female Athletes Collaborate and Compete. Kenesha Atwater got pregnant at 18, but her dreams did not fade when her son was born. Today, she plays basketball for Florida Gulf Coast University on an athletic scholarship that allows her to go to college so she can give her son the childhood she never had. Brian Burnsid reports for NCAA Champion Magazine in Fort Myers, Florida.
Erlene and Hilton Atwater had their first child together when Erlene was just 15 years old. Over the next 15 years, the two would have five more, including Kenesha, the youngest. Hilton was as enamored with Kenesha as she was with him. As she explains, Kenesha clung to her father until 2005 when he passed away from a stroke.
I couldn't grasp it all. Like, I couldn't grasp that I was never going to see him again because he was, like, I was his little girl.
Kenesha felt alone for the first time in her life. Because her father loved sports and she needed a salve, she picked up a basketball. In 10th grade, she was barred from playing because of her grades. But the bench wasn't for Kenesha, and memories of her father motivated her to change.
My basketball coach, Alvin Hamilton, like literally drove by at like 11 o'clock at night and see me shooting on the court after coming from prom.
By her senior year, Kenesha was one of the top-ranked players in Florida with a 3.4 grade point average, and college coaches called regularly. Hilton Atwater had given all of his children the gift of athleticism, yet his baby girl, his heart, was poised to be the only one who took full advantage. Late in her senior year, Kenesha signed a letter of intent to play basketball and attend school at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. A little more than a week later, she found out she was pregnant and decided to stay home to take care of her baby and turn down the basketball scholarship.
After finding out I was pregnant, I thought everything was over. I thought I wasn't going to be able to play basketball anymore.
On December 28, 2011, Old Dominion lost to Tennessee. Kenesha should have been there. Instead, 2 days later, her water broke. After 28 hours of labor, Kenesha met her son, Andarius. But when the nurse placed him in Kenesha's arms, she felt how heavy 6 pounds, 2 ounces could be. Her mother's words were the remedy that loosened shame's grip.
She said to me, look, we're going to have to do what we have to do. You know, you have a child now. People are going to judge you your whole life. Don't worry about what anybody has to say. I'm here and I support you 100%.
Kenesha was convinced her father's gift had wasted away in the month she spent in the hospital after Andarius was born. Then, on a spring day, she answered a phone call from an assistant coach at Virginia Commonwealth University asking if Kenesha still wanted to play basketball. When VCU said scholarship, Kenesha's brothers nudged her away from plans of community college and diapers and nap time. On the day her son turned 8 months old, Kenesha packed 7 outfits and 3 pairs of shoes into a single suitcase and left for Virginia.
You know, I put on a fake smile. I mean, it was hard for me to talk to everyone about my problem.
She started 12 games for VCU and was the team's third leading scorer, but counted the days until she could see Andarius. On rare trips home, he reacted like she was a stranger, screaming for her to put him down. Eventually, she decided she would finish her freshman year, then enroll somewhere close to home. Kenesha returned to Florida in the summer of 2013 with a year-and-a-half-old son, a year of college credit, and a mountain of uncertainty. Then, out of the blue, the basketball coach at Florida Gulf Coast University reached out to her on Facebook, offering Kenesha a different life. She is now an integral part of the Eagles team that captured an Atlantic Sun Conference championship last year and this season attained a top 25 ranking. And a college degree, the elusive ticket to a new life for her and her son, is finally within reach.
I'm thankful for being able to be here and getting a second chance at anything. I'm thankful for being able to go to school for free and get an education for my son.
For decades, a birth often marked the death of a college career. News reports told stories of scholarships that weren't renewed and of pregnant athletes whose fear of losing their place on a team steered them to abortions. Those accounts spurred culture change. In 2008, Division I adopted legislation preventing athletes from losing scholarships for medical reasons the year they became pregnant. 98% of teen moms do not graduate college before they turn 30. Kenesha, though, is on the cusp of being counted among the other 2%. She is on pace to receive a degree in criminal justice in May 2016. Kenesha is trying to thwart her own long odds to ensure Andarius thwarts his, and she is almost there. Almost. For NCAA Champion Magazine in Fort Myers, Florida, I'm Brian Burnsed.
Best known for her books about the joys of life in Italy, Frances Mays has published a new memoir, but this time she takes her readers back to her roots in the tiny town of Fitzgerald, Georgia. Lilia Fukin has the story.
Frances Mays, author of the best-selling book Under the Tuscan Sun, has a new book out, Under Magnolia. This time, Mays brings her sense of wonder and love for travel home to her formative years steeped in the deep South culture of Georgia. In her signature lyrical prose, Mays recounts some of her early life's sweet and sour moments.
It's hard to even imagine from this vantage where the internet, the television, everything connects you with everything else. But at that time we were isolated. It was like being in a green terrarium. It was our own world. And I wanted to write about a world like that because I know that life there is passionate and that people live vivid, important lives in those flyover places.
That's how Mays sees it now, but when she was growing up, she dreamed of escaping the flyover place she called home.
I wanted to get into the wide world. Even as a high school student, I pictured myself in Paris with a ponytail and big sunglasses.
When Mays started to look at colleges, her grandfather, Daddy Jack, gave only one restriction.
You can go anywhere you want as long as it's not north of the Mason-Dixon line. So I got as far as Virginia, and I got to this wonderful, tough women's college in Lynchburg, and I was constrained all around because they had, at that time, so many rules.
Her parents, Garbert and Frankie, had the fatal gift of beauty.
And I think that beauty was, in a way, a curse because I think they both expected that life would just enlarge around them.
Her father was an explosive, difficult man. And, as Mays writes, to complicate that, he died at 47.
He was a very wild boy. He was sent off to Georgia Military Academy because he pushed a high school teacher down the stairs. And he was always in trouble. But he played the saxophone, he raised doves, he did a lot of sweet things in his youth as well.
Mays, a gourmet cook, shows a deep appreciation for her mother's culinary accomplishments.
She made monumental cakes. Her Lane cake, it's got about 90 ingredients, has fruit in it and is very layered. She could bake, and she always decorated her cakes, like my birthday cake was always with pink icing, and she always put camellias around it.
As a little girl, Mays was captivated by the hot, lush landscape of Georgia.
I loved getting in the woods and looking for arrowheads and swimming in the rivers and swinging out over vines into springs, and had a very big connection with nature.
Perhaps even more importantly, she found solace and escape in books.
I think the library in my hometown definitely saved me a lot of confrontation with the rest of my family because I could always go hide with a book.
Here, Frances Mays reads from her new memoir, Under Magnolia, at a point where she's retreated from one of her father's inexplicable outbursts.
When his friends go, my father stays at the table with his tumbler of bourbon. I'm reading with a flashlight under the covers. My specialty is orphans on islands, where houses have trap doors into secret passageways that lead to the sea. Rowboats, treasure, and no parents in the story.
For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Lilia Fukin.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1353.